And he said, what separated today when I finally got cast in the Broadway company to the other six auditions? And I said, because you've been taking class.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Voracious Student. I'm Denis Emile-Lambert, your host. And my guest today is casting director Jamie Beth Margolis. Jamie Beth has been casting for 20 years. She's cast a bunch of the big Broadway shows. At her casting office now, she also develops new plays and musicals. She teaches at the BFA acting program at Pace and elsewhere. She directs. She does all sorts of cool stuff. Also, happy Hanukkah to those of you who celebrate. I am not Jewish, but my partner is and my roommate is. So every night this week, we've been lighting the candles and they've been saying the Hebrew prayer, and I've started to learn the Hebrew prayer. I'm only a couple words in. It's harder than I thought. And I've been learning a bit about Jewish history. Last night we were talking about Jewish weddings. And so to build on that, I thought it would be fun this week to talk to Jamie Beth about the National Yiddish Theater, where she is the casting director and the general manager. So the first half of this episode focuses on that. We learned a little bit about its history, and we dive into its recent hit production of Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish. Jamie Beth won an Artios Award this year for casting it. It starred Stephen Sky Bell, and it was directed by Joel Grey and was just a major event in New York. The second half of the episode, we talk all about auditions, casting, all that stuff. Jamie Beth has a lot of great thoughts on that. Enjoy. Jamie Beth, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you do so many things, but I'd love to focus today on the National Yiddish Theater. What is your position there?
So currently at the National Yiddish Theater, I am the casting director and the general manager.
And why is the Yiddish theater and its history so important to the greater theater community?
Well, there's actually a number of reasons that that is the case. The first one is because in 1897, the Hebrew Actors Union was founded, and it was the first performing arts union in America. Broadway and the Yiddish theaters of Second Avenue turned New York City into the theater capital of the world. So essentially, the Hebrew Actors Union predates Actors Equity Association. So it's very important to the unionization of theater. The Yiddish theater was the largest and most important of the American immigration. There were dozens of Yiddish theaters along Second Avenue, from Houston to 14th Street, and in the boroughs and all over America. And they catered to Yiddish speakers who wanted entertainment to take them out of their dreary everyday lives. And the plays and musicals of the Yiddish theater varied from sentimental melodramas all the way to high art. Many of the stars of the Yiddish theater transitioned to the English and the Broadway stage, as did the composers and other theater professionals. So I'll just give you a couple of examples of people that kind of went from the Yiddish theater to mainstream that we know: Fivish Finkel, Molly Picon, Jacob Adler, who was the father of Stella Adler. And one of the other things that I thought about today that I wanted to share was the beginning of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue is Yiddish in tone. So we think about a lot of these composers like the Gershwins that really started on Tin Pan Alley and then contributed, of course, to Broadway. So there's so much that the Yiddish theater gave to Broadway, from performers, composers, entertainers, as well as political theater. One of the things about the National Yiddish Theater, when it was founded as the Volksbühne 106 years ago, it's the people's stage, and it definitely had a political bent to it in its beginnings. So many important contributions.
Do you find that young actors know the history of it?
No, I don't think so. It's not something that's covered in a lot of programs in theater history, which I've taught. I don't think we ever taught Yiddish theater, ever.
Well, we're going to teach them tonight.
Yes. I mean, I taught theater history, and still, when I started working for the National Yiddish Theater, had a whole lot to learn about the culture of the theater and its long history. The National Yiddish Theater, by the way, is the longest consecutive running theater in the United States at 106 consecutive seasons.
I didn't know that. That's incredible.
Yes.
And how long have you been there for?
I have been there since 2012. And that's one of the things that I want to point out about the National Yiddish Theater. When I was hired by the theater, I was hired as the festival producer to produce the festival citywide that celebrated the Volksbühne's 100th anniversary. In 2015, when the theater turned 100, we had a citywide festival to celebrate all of that culture. And when I was initially hired by them, I was the festival producer for that event. Luckily, after that event happened in 2015, I got to stay there in the job I have now.
And over those years, what would you say your proudest moment personally was?
Well, I think I have two, if that's okay.
Of course it's okay.
The first one is opening night of that 2015 festival. To celebrate with so many amazing international artists all across the city was an absolutely incredible experience. There were so many artists that I didn't even know about until I worked for the Volksbühne. There was a klezmer group that came from Japan. There was an incredible theater company from Montreal that did a production of the Dybbuk that I will never forget. It was one of the most incredible productions I've seen. So there were so many international artists on the scene, and it was really a great event. But I think that for me was definitely topped by the opening night of the original cast of the Yiddish Fiddler on the Roof. That was, I think, for all of us, an incredible moment.
Let's talk a little bit more about Fiddler. I know that production just moved so many people and was such an event in New York. Let's start with this. What was the most challenging thing about working on that show?
For me, it was bringing a show to Safra Hall, to the National Yiddish Theater's venue, that was much larger than most of the shows that had ever been done there before, and also a much-loved classic in the Yiddish language. And as a casting director, casting Fiddler on the Roof in Yiddish. So that was definitely one of my most challenging experiences that I've ever had as a casting director, and also one of the most rewarding ones as well.
And what was your very favorite thing about working on the show?
Joel Grey. Having someone like Joel Grey helm the show as director was the most incredible experience. His collaboration with his designers was remarkable. His camaraderie and connection with the actors was amazing. He comes from a Yiddish theater background. His father was Mickey Katz show, lots of klezmer, lots of Yiddish. He wasn't a Yiddish speaker when the show began, which was also really incredible, but he had such a connection to the material. And he was so invested in every audition, so respectful of every actor. And also, I guess being an actor and director himself, that combination, he was able to bring out the most genuine performances I've ever seen in a Fiddler on the Roof production.
And when you say he was invested in the audition, let's unpack that a bit. Do you mean he wanted to just fully explore every option that came into the room, or that he wanted to support the actors?
It was actually all of the above. He would get up from behind the table and work with people, pull them aside and kind of give them secret direction. He would strive to take away anything from their performance that resembled a production that they had done before or had resembled shtick in any way, and made it honest, made it earnest, made it genuine. He brought out how important it was to connect to the language that was probably the language that they spoke. It made it seem more genuine because of that. And he would pair actors together in auditions in ways that I had never seen before, even having cast for 20 years. He would, you know, do a mix and match and try to see people together and explore every opportunity for the best cast that we could have.
Then it transferred, and then there's future productions planned as well, right?
Right. So before the pandemic, unfortunately, hit, the show had transferred, opened and closed at Stage 42 on 42nd Street. And there was a national tour planned, as well as a production in Australia, in Melbourne and Sydney. So both of those were on the horizon, really exciting opportunities for the show, and both were put on hold for the pandemic. But hopefully we'll still be something that we get to see in the near future.
Are there people in us, you know, is that, what are the challenges in casting a show in Yiddish? How is that different than casting a show in English?
Right. First of all, I do want to answer that question that you did ask about Australia. I was actually extremely amazed that there is a large Yiddish-speaking community in Melbourne, and all of them were so incredibly giving to the show's audition process, including helping the team find audition readers, showing up for the roles, hosting people at their homes for dinner. It was amazing. So I do want to say that.
You caught me. I censored myself. I almost asked it. And then I said, is that an embarrassing question? Is that an offensive question? But I'm glad you caught me, and I'm glad you answered. It's just not the first place I think of doing Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah. I think it was, destined to be extremely popular in Australia and certainly the U.S. tour. But yeah, I do want to talk a little bit about the casting process from the actor's point of view for Fiddler on the Roof, because it's something for me as a casting director that really struck me. So for the initial audition, they would come in, sing a song, and we would ask every actor that we were interested in to repeat back a line in Yiddish. So we could hear if the actor had the ear for the language. If the actor had the ear for the language, the voice that we were looking for, types that we were looking for, we would call the actor back. And this is where it gets really interesting, because we would send the actor a Dropbox file. And in that file contained the audition material, song and sides, that you would get for any musical, but also contained a Yiddish pronunciation guide, and also contained MP3s of the show's Yiddish language coach speaking all of the lines in Yiddish. Furthermore, which was really amazing, every single page of the script and score was notated as follows: the Yiddish line, the exact English translation to the Yiddish line, and the lines written by Bach and Harnikenstein. So you would see all three, one under the other, on every single page. And the actor said it was the most incredible experience, because you don't drill the same way for that kind of audition. Not only are you looking for the intent and what you want to bring to the role, but also how you're going to process that language for that audition.
Roughly what percentage of the actors spoke Yiddish?
Very few. In the actual company, final original company of the show, there was 3 or 4 Yiddish speakers out of a cast of 26.
Wow.
But what I did find, and I think it bears noting, is that actors who had a background in opera or a background in speaking in Hebrew or German had a very easy time picking it up. So I started looking for that on people's resumes. The more we would get into the process, I would, they've performed in opera. Oh, they speak German. They speak Hebrew. They have an ear for languages.
Yeah, and the fear of it is less. It's just part of their job. You know, they're used to doing that. And would you say that that was a big consideration in casting or a minor consideration in casting?
It was definitely a big consideration, because the rehearsal process was so short. And yes, one of the interesting things about the National Yiddish Theater contract is that it allows for pre-rehearsal Yiddish coaching. So we knew that there would be a chance for the actors to be coached by the Yiddish coaches prior to the first actual rehearsal, which is extremely helpful. But even then, it's not enough time for someone who has, you know, never been, let's say, exposed to a foreign language production, probably, to pick it up.
Right. Did you see that documentary about Fiddler?
Yes, I love it.
Oh my God. Crying.
It's incredible.
So beautiful.
I know. Everyone should see it. Miracle of miracles.
Just so beautiful.
I had the pleasure of working on it for 2 days when they worked with Stephen Sky Bell and Joel Grey. So it was amazing.
And what did you learn from watching Stephen do that role?
Stephen is the best Tevye ever. Because every single moment was truth for Stephen. He understood the culture, the language, the character. He brought everything together. And one of the things I find really interesting about Stephen was the last time I had seen him prior to the audition for Fiddler was as Laser Wolf in the Broadway company of Fiddler. That was in the Bartlett Chair production. And I was like, wow, he's incredible. And then I found out he'd been studying Yiddish. And I was like, wow, we have to see Stephen Sky Bell for this. And I think without a doubt, everyone behind the table will tell you that from his first audition, we were pretty much sold that he was the one.
You had your Tevye.
Yeah, he just, also, I, He was also a true father to everyone in the company. I felt like everyone could just learn from him, his discipline, and everything that he brought to the role on stage.
It's so nice when that happens. When you know, when your leading actors are actually leading the company off stage as well, I think it makes a huge difference.
And he definitely was all of that.
Let me ask you, has the Yiddish theater experienced any anti-Semitic threats and challenges in its history?
I mean, I can't necessarily speak to its full history, but I can speak to a recent event that happened. We were doing a reading, a community reading, and during that reading, there was an anti-Semitic Zoom bombing that happened. And I think, you know, aside from the usual things that you'll see at our shows, like extra security, because our theater is located in the Museum of Jewish Heritage, this Zoom bombing definitely made us really keenly aware of things that we need to do to keep our productions safe and secure, especially now online.
That's really crazy that that happened online.
Definitely. And I know the actors, it really affected them, for sure.
Yeah, of course. That's terrible. So let's talk about some of the other things you have done. You've been casting for 20 years. You've cast so many of the big, big, big Broadway musicals. There are so many things I could ask you. But what I think I want to ask you, and there might not be an answer to this, but is there one audition that stands out in your mind in all your years of casting that stands out as particularly extraordinary?
Yes. It is actually an audition for Les Miserables that happened. It was early-ish in my casting career, actually. Someone walked in and sang the Eponine material. And I know we were all looking at each other going, this person's incredible. This person has the most amazing voice. This person has such star quality. This person really understands all the many facets of Eponine, wearing her heart on her sleeve, the vulnerability, all those facets. And that person was Sutton Foster, who I got to cast in Les Miserables.
Wow.
And it was such an amazing experience watching Sutton audition for Eponine. I will never forget that audition. And everything that she just brought into the room with her naturally.
I'm trying to like think in her history what she had done before that.
Annie.
But she wasn't someone you knew.
Mm-mm. No, not at that audition.
Do you find that like casting those big shows, what are the particular challenges of casting a long, big running musical like that, like Les Mis and Cats and...
For me, I, as a casting director, I love casting long-running shows. That would be my dream job if I could always do that. Casting replacements is very, very special because it takes a casting director who has a lot of imagination to dispel the myth that every time that you have to cast a role, it needs to be cookie cutter to the original. Because a lot of people think that, and that's not at all true. I hear that all the time from actors that are friends of mine that I work with. And for me as casting director, I always like to think about what are the many ways I could cast this role now that it's come open again. And I love that challenge. And going to the shows over and over again, and they were never the same to me.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Of course, there are challenges that go with it, like, you know, not being able to transpose a score to match someone's voice per se. But besides those challenges, I love the challenge of replacement casting. I would be happy doing, you know, 15 Mariuses and 12 Grisabellas. And one time I tried to do a tally like that.
And you have done something like that, I think, right?
Yes.
What do you think the single most important trait is in actors auditioning?
I actually think that it is an actor's ability to show self-confidence and let their talent shine through while simultaneously tempering their ego. Whenever I find an actor like that in the room, I want to hire that actor for every show I cast because I know that actor is going to walk through the door prepared, ready to take adjustments, ready to run with the curveballs, ready to commit to something that will be 10, 12 hours a day as of a process. And I totally admire that in a performer.
And is that a delicate balance? Like, do you find it's easy for actors to fall on one side or the other? Like, they just aren't quite projecting the confidence, or are just projecting a little bit of arrogance?
Yes, I find it is really difficult. And it takes actors a while to figure that out. How to best, you know, mix those two in the room.
Yeah, that's tricky. And, you know, as an actor, based on how well I know the material and how well I know the team, my given level of natural confidence is always varying, you know, so it can be easy to overcompensate. It can be easy to not trust that you have it when you do have it. So I like that. I like that. You teach at Pace. What has teaching online been like for you?
Well, nothing can replace being in the classroom with your students, especially actors. You want to be in the room with them. You want to feel their energy. You want to feel their, you know, essence. You want to see them deliver these incredible performances in person. But I found that my classes have translated really well to Zoom. I've kind of gotten used to it. And I feel like some of the best performances that I've seen have been on Zoom. I don't know if it's because actors are comfortable working in their self-tape zones in their own homes for class, or, you know, there isn't that pressure of having just run on the subway that was late and this and that. You know, taking away some of those, I'll call them New York situations,
totally,
has actually been really nice as well. So I've enjoyed that pivot to Zoom. I've enjoyed learning all the ins and outs and all the many things you can do on Zoom. When I first started, I thought, I'm just going to do this, this, and this. And then I learned how creative you can be. I watched my Pace students in a play that replaced what was to be the play for, you know, the late fall semester. And the creativity in a Zoom play was astounding. They actually looked like they were moving within a set. And everything was absolutely well rehearsed and incredible. So the moments were there, and I was convinced all of a sudden that Zoom was a good thing for us.
Well, you know where it's so helpful, I find, especially if you are primarily a theater actor, is that I've just become so comfortable with the camera always being in my face and working within the frame all the time.
Oh, yeah. I think it's making my students incredible television and film actors. I've seen them do some film scenes, some commercial copy, very impressive on Zoom.
So tell me, what are your hopes and goals and dreams for 2021, both personally for the Yiddish Theater, anything that you want to share?
So for the Yiddish Theater, one of the shows that we had to cancel, postpone because of the quarantine, because of COVID, was a Yiddish language production of The Tenth Man by Paddy Chayefsky. This translation I thought was incredible. I actually finished casting the show and was extremely, extremely proud of this cast. Some Yiddish speakers, some non-Yiddish speakers, really coming together so beautifully. And I was very excited to see what that production would be like because of the popularity of the play itself, but then translating it into Yiddish as well. So I look forward to the National Yiddish Theater being able to bring that production back.
Yeah,
it was something that I know our audiences were also very excited about. The other thing that is on the Yiddish Theater's plate is the Barry Manilow and Bruce Sussman musical Harmony, which also tells another really important story of the comedian harmonists. And I am really looking forward to working on that one as well.
And what's the basic storyline of Harmony?
So the comedian harmonists were performing in Europe at the time of the rise of Hitler, the rise of the Nazis, the concentration camps, and so forth. They were actually, at the time, considered as popular as the Beatles in America. They're a group of singers, five of them, and they were basically stopped and torn apart by the war because two of the group members were Jewish. So they had risen to incredible fame in Europe, and it's such a wonderful story. Each of the harmonists personally had an amazing story to tell. So you put it all together, it's a really incredible musical. One of the things that I really look forward to in the coming year is to continue to develop new musicals, which is something that I do out of my office.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Yeah, so my office is a casting and production office that I own and operate. And one of the things that's really important to me about the production arm is the development of new musicals, working with new writers, helping them to tell their stories, to develop their shows. I help them workshop their musicals. I help them do readings of their musicals, bringing expertise to the table through directing, through musical directors. It's been absolutely incredible. I oftentimes will cast their demo recordings for them. And I absolutely love working on new shows. I have a show that I've been working on for quite some time called Warsaw, which I've directed a couple of readings of in New York and beyond New York, including in Florida. And it is a musical about the Warsaw Ghetto uprising during the Holocaust, which I definitely still hope to bring into New York, especially now, this many years after the event. It seems like the perfect time to tell the story again.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else you want to talk about, Jamie Beth? Anything under the sun?
goodness. Well, I think that I do want to talk about casting directors for a second.
Let's do it.
Because one of the reasons that I love being a casting director, and there are so many, too many to talk about tonight, is the fact that as a casting director, we get to be the yes person in the room. And I want all the actors out there who are listening to this to remember that we as casting directors are on your side. We want you to be amazing. We want you to get the job. We can be that person who, you know, sneaks out into the Zoom waiting room or sneaks out into the hallway at Pearl Studios to say, sing this, not that, or they're really looking for this, or give you that little note or that little word of encouragement. You know, or tell you, try something else or whatever it is. We're the ones on your side trying to make the show the best possible show. So that and the fact that I get to give actors jobs is the most exciting thing.
I have a follow-up question because I feel like a fear that haunts a lot of actors and really gets in a lot of actors' ways is this fear of messing up so badly that they will never be invited in the room again. So how poorly does an actor have to perform in order for you to, you know, sort of take them off the table for all projects for a while?
Right. I don't think that should be an actor's fear. I mean, I think the way I put it for myself is this, and this is the way that I've sort of written it down for myself in a way when I just put together my thoughts on a day of casting. As a casting director, for me, it is not important that an actor books a job. It is very, very hard for an actor to book a job, and I respect that. What is important to me is that an actor tries in the audition room. Things can go south because of so many different variables, but the first thing I look for is, okay, is the actor on time? Great. Did the actor prepare what I ask and not make excuses? Great. You know, can I control it when a director throws a curveball at an actor and the actor doesn't understand it? No. And I don't hold that against an actor. You know, can I control it when an actor comes in for Carousel and they're asked to sing from Footloose? No. These are the things I can't control. You know, if an actor's audition spirals, I don't hold it against the actor, but I do expect a certain level of on-time professionalism, preparation. That is what's key to me. You know, looking great and being the best that you can be in the circumstance, but there's going to be things that happen. I mean, I'm going to share a story with you right now because it's one of those stories that I will never forget as a casting director. As an actor, I urge you all to read the Who's in the Room sign. Who's in the audition room? Who's sitting behind the table today? Who's in the Zoom room? Read. People do not read things thoroughly. That's what I found. So an actor that I respect very much came in for an audition and did not read that and sang a song that incidentally was written by a composer that was sitting behind the table that the actor did not think that the composer or register that that composer was sitting behind the table. So the actor came in, sang the song, and the composer jumped up from behind the table and said, "No, no, 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 I wrote it like this," and called the actor over to the piano to expressly explain the meaning of the song, the incorrect tempos, and so forth. Now, I kept wavering between putting myself in the position of the composer and the position of the actor at this particular moment. I just think it was a great lesson because I went out in the hall after, and the first thing I did, because that's me, is like, are you okay? Don't worry about it. Are you okay? You're a terrific singer, great performer. Like, things happen. Okay. And then, did you realize that this person was in the room? No. These are the things, being astute, being aware of what's going on around you can really help save the day. Because the actor said to me, oh gosh, if I had known that that composer was in the room, I never would have sang that song. And I was like, yep.
That's such good advice. And it's a really good point because as you're talking, I'm thinking about the amount of times whatever has been on the breakdown or whatever my agent has told me, like so-and-so will be in the room, often it changes. And so I think that's really good advice. Piggybacking on what you're talking about before, in terms of like how poorly do you have to audition to be taken off the table, I think actors can be way too hard on themselves. I know I have. And I know as I've gotten a little older.
I completely agree. I've had so many actors over the years say to me, oh, I thought you'd never call me in again. And I said, why not? Of course I'm going to give you another chance when you're right for something.
And then also I think that correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, especially as this show is all about growth, that you understand that, you know, artists develop and they get better and they change and they grow.
Well, that's a very, very important point because I actually had an actor, a singer dancer that I adore that I cast in Cats on his 7th audition for the show. And he said to me, wow, I'm so happy that you trusted me to bring me in this many times. And he said, what separated today when I finally got cast in the Broadway company to the other 6 auditions? And I said, because you've been taking class. You've been working on your dancing. Your dancing is much better. You've seen a vocal coach. Your song choices were much better. You've shown this incredible amount of dedication and improvement over these auditions, and you deserve to be in the show. And I think that is really important, what you're saying. We can't just stop studying and, you know, assume that we know everything.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, that's what this podcast is about. And I'm a bit of a broken record. And it's certainly not necessarily about being a student in the obvious sense, but it's just about constantly learning, constantly changing, constantly growing.
But as an actor, you can use this pandemic time to really work on things without spending money.
Yes.
This is the time to fix your reel, improve your website, fix your audition rep book, do all those things that you can be doing at home right now so that you're sure you can really be ready to go when the time comes.
And, you know, I was talking with a friend the other day too, the Zoom has made, you know, the world so much smaller. If there's someone in LA you wanted to study with that was maybe only teaching in person before, now you can, and pretty much anyone and everyone, even if they're not advertising it, is doing private coaching.
I've done several Zoom coachings with actors and rep book overhauls during this pandemic, and it's been awesome.
I love that. So if anyone's interested in that, where can they find you?
Oh, yes. I can be reached on Facebook at Jamie Beth Margolis Casting and Productions very easily. My page, you can private message me there. I answer all messages on my Facebook page.
Great. And I will put that link in the show notes too, so people can easily find you. Jamie Beth, you are a delight. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being here with me.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here and to get to chat with you about so many important topics.
Absolutely. And happy Hanukkah.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Talk to you soon.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Jamie Beth. It was great to talk to her about the National Yiddish Theater, that production of Fiddler on the Roof, which is a show I love so much. I think what she said about the balance between confidence and lack of ego in auditions is a really tricky and important thing to find. I hadn't heard it phrased quite that way, but I loved that. I remember someone saying once, you have to care and not care at the same time. And I mean, like, care with every ounce of your being and also not care with every ounce of your being. Easier said than done. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review it. You can find me at The Voracious Student on Instagram. Give us a follow. Send me a message if you have any thoughts. Thank you for listening. Happy Hanukkah. Happy holidays. And I will talk to you very soon.